I'm Bob McCowan. He's John Shannon.
Hello, everybody.
And once again, we're together.
You're sounding better today, Robert.
Marginally better.
Is it the drugs? Is it the drugs?
No drugs.
Oh, okay.
Not taking anything.
Wow.
Chicken soup. I've had about enough chicken soup, I can tell you. I've been eating chicken soup for lunch and dinner all week.
Well,
chicken soup is great when you're sick for a couple of times. And then, you know, then you start looking around. I go, oh, I don't really want anything else.
Just a minute, Bob. Hey, Mickey, cancel the chicken soup.
Yeah, don't send any more chicken soup. Honest to Rudy. And I've done the packaged chicken soup, like the Lipton packages. Oh, yeah, yeah. And then I've done the canned thing, the Campbell's canned thing, trying to mix it up a little bit. But chicken soup is chicken soup at the end of the day.
What about DoorDash? You've probably done DoorDash too.
I actually haven't. I mean, it's literally been chicken soup and maybe a grilled cheese sandwich if I feel really aggressive. Good. Anyway, thank you for asking, John.
Well, we're always concerned. And when I walk down the street, people say, how is Bob?
No, they don't. They don't do it. Not once have they ever done that. You lie like a rug. They couldn't give a flying fadoo. We're going to talk to one of our friends, one of the good guys in sports in general, just in hockey. Jim Nill is the general manager of the Dallas Stars. They got off to a really crummy start.
They didn't win a regulation game. I think it was game 12. Anytime they won a game, it was always in an overtime or a shootout. So there was a little bit of panic going on in Dallas.
Well, yeah. And I mean, you know, it didn't get as much attention as Montreal and Vancouver.
Nope.
Both of whom wound up making changes. Dallas righted the course. And nobody has been victimized as a result of their poor start. So we're going to address that and a bunch of other things with the GM of the Dallas Stars, Jim Nill, when we come back right after this. McCowan and Shannon back with you on the podcast/radio program. And with us today is the general manager of the Dallas Stars. Jim Nill is with us. How are you doing? You look good.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that. It's always good to hear. My wife doesn't always give me those compliments, so that's good. But good morning to you guys, and thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for joining us. You're on the road with your team. Is that a common occurrence for you?
Yeah, it is. You know, just the way the game is now with you know, the salary cap, call-ups, you know, this COVID situation, there's something that happens every day, it seems like, in today's world. So I think it's important to be there to support the coaches and the players. Something that's really different, too. You know, I came up in the Detroit system, and I was very fortunate in Detroit. I could go to a game every night there. You know, you had University of Michigan, you had OHL, you had under 18 team. Grand Rapids was 2 hours down the road. In Dallas, for me to go to a game, it's a week long adventure. You know, I got to plan it out a week in advance, and you know, everything's a 3 hour flight wherever you want to go, 4 hours up to Ontario, and so it's really different that way. I really had to change kind of my, you know, I'm a manager, as they say, and to be a good manager, you got to hire good people and let them do the work. And that's what I've had to learn to do.
Actually, Jimmy, it's one of the fascinating stories that people in the hockey world don't really understand. Dallas, to being in the center of the continent, is really isolated, isn't it?
Yeah, we're very isolated. We're, our closest flight is an hour and a half. That'd be St. Louis. Everything is pretty well 2 hours. Kind of our common theme when we land, when we come back from a road trip, say we go to Chicago for one game or Minnesota, it's 2:30 in the morning by the time we get home. So that's just it's reality. But you know, because of that, we adjust some things we do. We get to travel different times and more days off, and we adjust that.
One of the roles of a general manager was always scouting, and I know that's less so now, but I gather you rely more on your scouts than you yourself going to see players. True.
That's very true. That's the number one thing I learned when I took this job. And I was fortunate. I had some great mentors. You know, I go back to, you know, Jimmy DeVolano, Ken Holland, Scotty Bowman. I've had some great mentors. And the one thing that I really learned is hire good people, let them do their job. And I love scouting. And I was always the guy rolling up my sleeve. Let's go find the next player. I can't do that in my role anymore. And it's up to my people. And I've got good people to do that. And I'm there to help them along the way. But as general manager, you got to oversee everything. But I'm no longer in charge of the amateur scouting or the pro scouting. I got good people that do that for me.
So when how many non-NHL games would you watch a year live?
Live? I go down to Austin. Now we're for our American League team's down in Austin. I try to get down there 4 to 5 times a month. So, you know, about 30 American League games. When I'm on the road once in a while, I might be able to, you know, if we head up to Canada and have a road trip, I can head out and catch some junior games or some college games. But I wouldn't say it's probably not more than 50 to 75.
And in Detroit, it would have been?
It's every night. You know, I'd be in the office in Detroit. Say we played last night in Detroit against San Jose at home. And then today I'd head over to Windsor, or I might go to the University of Michigan, watch a game, or down to Grand Rapids and be home in bed by 1 o'clock that next day. So it's a big difference. I really had to adjust the way I used to work. I really had to make an adjustment that way.
This may sound like an obvious question, but do you spend more time watching video as a result of not being able to go to games?
Yes, great question. Yes, I do. A lot of video and a lot of watching just games on TV live. I do a lot of that. And that's a great question. We've done a lot more video. You know, my scouts are out there. I get their lists. They say, here's a guy to watch, and I'll have our video people tape something, and then I'll go watch it. But I got to be careful, too, because it's not the same as live. Mm-hmm. It is a little bit different.
You touched on the COVID issue. With what's gone on, and the commissioner yesterday said that 19 of 32 teams have had to revert to different COVID protocols because of outbreaks. How concerned are you about it between, say, now and the Olympic break?
Well, we're very concerned. You know, I just got up this morning, kind of a routine is we test, you know, we'll have a test done, you know, say yesterday, and we get the results sometime early this morning. So you wake up, you grab your phone, and your heart's pounding because you're just like, let's hope we're negative. You know, say if we had a game tonight, you're really worried. You know, we're on the road. All of a sudden, if we get 3 or 4 positive tests, I probably can't get any players up here. Depending on our injury and our reserve list, you know, where we're at for our roster, I might not have room to add 3 or 4 players. And so every day you pick up your phone and you're waiting for that email to come through from the testing company, and you just hope it's negative. So it has changed the landscape.
Would you like the taxi squad back?
Yes and no. For the NHL team, yes. For the players and their development, no. That's something that we've really found is last year has turned out to be a major burden for some of these young kids that we had on the taxi squads. Didn't play in the American League, or played a little bit in the American League, but mostly in the taxi squads. And, you know, it was a pretty good life. You know, they're flying around on jet airplanes, or, you know, nice hotels, playing every once in a while, but not a lot. And now all of a sudden they came to training camp and they got to try to make the team. They thought they were so close, but now they find out they're not that close. Now they go down the American League, and the American League isn't what it was last year, because most of the guys in taxi squads were the best players, were up with the NHL teams. Now the majority of them are down in the American League, and the American League's tougher. Guys that had success down there now aren't having success, and they can't figure out why. And it's been hard on the development part of young kids, the taxi squad. So for our team up top, yes, would be great to have. For the development of the younger players, a little concerned about that.
Has this been a topic of conversation among the general managers and within the league, the notion of the taxi squad?
Yeah, we've talked about it. You know, there's some teams that got in tough situations. And, maybe is it a hybrid or something? I don't know. You're allowed to have maybe an extra goalie up top, or an extra 1 or 2 players. It's a tough thing. We're fighting through it. And you just don't want there to be a competitive disadvantage or advantage because of COVID. That's the tough part. You know, some teams, you know, New York Islanders been decimated. We went through it last year. We got hit early, missed a lot. Then we had an unfortunate storm and never caught up. And it's tough. It's a grind. So, and it affects the balance of the schedule.
Actually, you bring up a question about the goaltenders. We ever since David Ayers won that game for Carolina in Toronto, we've almost kind of made heroes out of these e-bugs, as they're called, emergency backup goaltenders. if you do that, isn't that really changing the balance of competition? And isn't wouldn't it be better to have a third goalie available for you at any time?
It is, but then, you know, everything's like an octopus. It grows, things grow from it that you don't think of. You know, so now you got a guy up there. He's not playing much. He's just practicing. And so how's his development? It's, you know, you better have to have an older guy. You know, what's the salary? How's it work against the cap? So there's so many things that kind of grow off these things. Mm-hmm. Would it be nice? Yes. If it's a younger player, he's not playing any games. Now you're hurting his development. And that position is so tough for development as it is. So it is something that we've talked about internally. We almost got to that point about 3-4 years ago. We were going to have a third guy. There's different things come into play. There was workman comps. Every state, every province has different rules for those type of situations. So there's a lot of things that affected it. So it's not as clear cut as we sometimes think.
With Jim Neal, the general manager of the Dallas Stars, your team didn't get off to a very good start. I don't have to tell you that. And all's well since then. But I'm intrigued by what a general manager thinks and does when that kind of stuff happens. Fans panic. Fans are looking for somebody's head. Fans think that that's you can't recover from it. Somebody has made a big mistake. What did you go through with that first, whatever, 9-10 games?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to have a good feel for your team. You know what you've put together. And have you misjudged some players? Is there some guys that maybe you thought were, you know, maybe younger players aren't ready yet? So does that need to change? Did you sign some free agent guys that just aren't fitting in? So you got to have a good feel for your team. And then you got to give your coaches a chance to work out the wrinkles. You know, it depends a little bit how you're losing. You know, does your team have your identity, but they're just not good enough? Now you got to do something drastic, make a trade maybe. Or is your team just struggling? They're not playing the way you've seen them play in the past. The coaches are trying to put in a new system. So you have to have a good feel for that. You know, and you mentioned it, that word patience. There's not much of it in the world anymore, but it is important in this position. You do have to have patience. It doesn't matter what you do in life. You got to have patience. You got to let people work through things. You got to let players work through everything. You know, we had a lot of guys... An example, a lot of guys missed a whole season because of injuries and surgeries. And to expect them to come back at 100% isn't fair to them. So we had to let them get it up and running. So there's different scenarios that you have to walk through. And, you know, and communication is important with the coaches. Where do they feel your team's at? With the players, where do they think their game's at? But... as you know, the temperature has been turned up in this world, and I think we need to turn it down. And sometimes you just got to let things settle in and see where we're at. And it used to be you'd start panicking at 25 or 30 games. Now we're panicking at 8 to 10 games. And yeah. I think that's where you got to be careful.
How do you talked about dialing it down. How do you do that?
I think that's where communication is important. Mm. Your style. You know, some guys are, you know, I'm competitive. I do have a temper, but I've learned that I got to bring that down. And you got to where does get mad at people and everything else? Where does that work sometimes? So you got to, sometimes you need to get mad at guys, but frustration sets in. So it's a real balancing act.
Your relationship with your coach, Rick Bowness. I see, and I've known both of you since both of you played. To me, it looks like a natural relationship, but you guys publicly hide your competitive styles. How would you describe your relationship with him?
Well, we have a very good relationship. You know, going back, a lot of people don't know this, but I played against Rick, and then Rick coached me in Winnipeg. So we got quite a relationship now. And then I worked with him in Ottawa. I was with the Ottawa Senators that first year of expansion. He was the coach there. And then we made full circle, came back here, and he was our assistant, then became the head coach. And we've got a great relationship. I respect him so much as a person. You know, first of all, as a person, you can't help. Rick Bowness is salt to the earth. He's got great values. He respects people. Players want to play for him. And then away from the rink, you wouldn't meet a better man. If you need something, And that doesn't mean we don't have great conversations. We have our moments and get mad and challenge each other, but you need to have that. And
speaking of those conversations, and I'm intrigued by this too, and not to dwell on the beginning of this season, but do you talk to your coach more during a losing streak, or are you inclined to back off and let him try and figure it out?
I talk to them more in between games. After games, I kind of stay away. You know, after you've had a tough loss, to go down in that dressing room, you know, I've got ideas what went wrong. They've got ideas. They've been in the heat of the battle. For me to go down there and to go in and toss a chair around or do something or get mad, that doesn't solve anything. Those guys have been in a battle, just been through a game. They know more of the situation than I do. I'm watching, but they're right down on the bench. They knew more of what's happened with the players. So it's something that I've learned, and I learned that, like, if I get back, I've learned this from, you know, Jimmy Devolinos and Ken Hollins and Scotty Bowman's. Let's sleep on it. And a lot of times things that look bad that night aren't as bad the next day. And now we can sit down as individuals and let's talk through it and kind of make the right thing. So I kind of monitor the situation of the game, and sometimes I'll just stay away from the dressing room. No sense going down there. I'll go check with the trainer who's injured. Do we have to make a call up or something? Kind of make a tour of the dressing room. But to go into that dressing room after a tough loss, that doesn't get you anywhere. And then the next morning, I'll sit down, go in, meet with the coaches, and then we'll walk through things.
I see. From a practical perspective, so last night you lost 4-0 in Los Angeles. How do you avoid talking to Rick when you're sitting across the aisle with him on the plane?
Well, it was a tough loss. The last couple of games haven't been great for us. And so I just stayed away. I went down, and then you're on the plane, but I can tell they're digging into the game and stuff. I just we'll say a few things. We had a few conversations. We sit next to each other on the bus and a few conversations, but we said, let's talk tomorrow. And we just leave it.
So when you were forced to get rid of Jim Montgomery, was there any doubt that Rick Bowness was the guy?
Under our situation, yes, it had to be Rick. He was a senior guy. I've got some great assistants here. You know, you start talking about John Stevens, these type of people. They've been head coaches. Todd Nelson, Derek Laxtal, all been head coaches. But Rick was the guy. I know that for the situation and the timing of it, I knew that he had the ear and the respect of the players, which was going to be important because it was a short turnaround. It was the next day. We had to make that decision. So I know that he had the respect of the players, and whatever his message was going to be, was going to be received by the players.
When earlier this season, I don't know whether the decision was yours or Rick's, but you actually changed positioning of some of those coaches. John Stevens went upstairs, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. We sat on talk and we said, you know what, we were struggling, and sometimes you get a different view. It's good to get a different, you know, go up top, watch the game, see some things that you may not be seeing from down below. It is a different perspective. So we had an internal talk and said, let's switch that up a little bit. You're trying to push every button when you're struggling. And if we all had the answer, you know, we'd push the right button, but we don't. So you try different things.
And of course, then when that happens, then everybody starts talking on social media that they're, because I know you follow a lot of people on Twitter, Jim. I know you follow people.
This Jay Shannon guy I always follow and stuff. And then there's this podcast I follow too.
So. Yeah, ignore that. Ignore that.
How do you manage to do that? Because you know people within your organization, heck, maybe even your owner, you know, start asking questions.
Yeah, no, they do. And but that's where you gotta believe in your values and your decisions. And we had a reason for doing it. There's situations every day that come up that you know that the social media world's not going to agree with, but if you follow that and believe in it, you're going to get yourself in trouble. So you got to stick with your beliefs and what you think is what's right for the team. That's the most important thing.
With Jim Neal, the general manager of the Dallas Stars, we'll take a quick break and come back with more right after these messages. Bob McCowan, it's John Shannon, and Jim Neal, the GM of the Dallas Stars, is with us. So you play in a market where the Cowboys are, well, we don't know what the Cowboys are. At the beginning of the year, they looked like they were going to be great.
They're just the biggest thing on the planet. That's all.
Yeah.
Well, And the Mavs aren't great this year. Rangers signed a couple of guys, big money guys. So you have competition within the other sports, especially at this particular time of year. Do you pay any attention to that? How much does it impact you in your role?
It doesn't impact me too much in my role, but do I pay attention to it? Yes, because, you know, we are a business. We have to operate as a business. We're very fortunate. We have a good following. It is a tough market. You know, the Cowboys are unique. They're their own package, and they've done a great job. I give them credit. What a great job they've done. They've built this new facility. It's out by our facility. And all the professional sports have facilities out kind of by us, the practice facilities, other than the baseball. And even saying that, the minor league teams right in behind our rink, their facility. So we're all kind of together. And I give the credit to the Cowboys. They built this facility in this little town that's all just, it's an unbelievable situation. So they've done a great job, and rightfully so. They should be where they're at. And then, like I said, we're in competition with the other ones. In the end, you got to win pretty consistently in these type of markets. It's important. You know, they'll put up with a little bit of rebuild, but it's competition. As long as you got a good product, we do pretty well. You know, we have a great rink down there. We share that with the Dallas Mavericks. And do I pay attention to it? Yes, that's part of the business. But in the end, you know, it's important to win and try to win consistently. That's the big thing.
What's your, do you know what the fan crossover base is? Like, are more of your fans, do they tend to be Cowboy fans or Rangers fans? Or I assume not Mavericks fans, because the seasons are parallels. There seems to be a definitive separation between the NHL and NBA.
Yeah, there's a big separation. Everybody's a Cowboys fan pretty well down there. Yeah. We've got an interesting demographics down in Dallas. A lot of transplants, or however you call that. A lot of people from California have moved into Texas. You know, we've had Toyota's move their head office to Texas. Chase Bank is in Texas. Tesla's down there. So a lot of companies have moved into Texas. So it's interesting when we come in, you know, when we come in to play LA Kings, we're going to have a lot of LA Kings fans. So it's really evolving. Whoever we're playing that night usually have their 2,000 or 3,000 fan base that come in to cheer them for that night. So it's an interesting dynamics that way.
As a guy who's a former scout, do you see a lot more kids from Texas playing the game and playing in the NHL one day?
Yes, that's something that our organization's done a great job. We have 7 what we call star centers. They built 7 arenas. This went way back when they first came here, and they started to add a couple since I've been here. And the minor league hockey, or the minor hockey association in Dallas, is strong, and it's very vibrant. It's done a great job. You know, you're talking Seth Jones, you know, Blake Coleman, we all know. And there's some young kids now down that have been drafted to WHL teams and going to college. So because of what the foundation that they built before I even got here, they've got a great hockey association down here.
It's still an expensive sport, though.
It is an expensive sport, very expensive. That's our biggest hurdle to our game growing.
Well, we all grew up in the era where if you were an athlete, you played everything. Yes. You know, you played baseball in the summer, and then you played hockey in the wintertime, and maybe you threw some basketball in there or whatever, football in the fall. That's really not the case anymore, Jimmy. Kids focus on a sport real early, don't they?
Yes, and that's probably my biggest, and, you know, now that you bring that up, you open up a can of worms here. That's my, I think that's one of our, I don't know what you call it, but faults or whatever, but it's important for kids to witness, to experience everything. And we don't do that anymore. And I think a little bit shame on us. I think we need to get back to that. There's nothing wrong with a young man learning how to hit a baseball when he's 6 years of age and play baseball all summer, or golf, or do lacrosse and play hockey. But we've got, I think, because of the expense of the sports, building arenas, they got to sell ice in the summertime. So they force coaches to buy practice time. And I think we've just got ourselves into a motion here where we're restricting kids, and I don't think it's right. I disagree with it. How we get out of that, I don't know.
But do you think it helps the quality of the talent? Kids playing, you know, 11, 12 months a year, where we used to play 5 months, maybe.
I probably made, and this is where the backlash comes, is you see these young kids coming out and out of these under 18 teams and out of junior, the skill level's never been better.
Never.
You know, it's amazing. Now, the trouble is that's a small percentage of the overall, you know, there's so many other kids still playing hockey that don't make it to that level.
Well, of course.
Would they be better off playing other sports? You know, the percentage of kids that ever make it to the pro level is so small. Are we restricting those other kids from witnessing other things, experiencing other things?
I'm curious, growing up in Hanna, Alberta, what was your summer sport? Baseball?
Baseball, a little bit of golf. Yeah. Yep.
Were you any good at baseball? You weren't going to get recruited to play baseball?
No,
like you were.
No, I was going to get recruited. No, I was going to get recruited. No, no. We played, actually fastball was a big thing. That was the big thing. Fastball. You know, we used to have the tournaments all around the small towns. We had a blast doing that. You know?
I bet. Yeah.
How's your golf game though?
Golf game could be better. As you become a GM, your golf game gets worse. But I love golf. I enjoy it. And just wish you had more time to do it.
You talk about the influences of Jimmy D and Kenny and Scotty. You played for Roger Neilson. I was part of that run with you guys in 82. It was quite something. Why didn't you become a coach rather than get into management?
Yeah, first of all, Roger, one of the best men you'll ever see. And it's amazing. He doesn't get credit. What coaches are doing now, Roger was doing 40 years ago. And it's amazing. First of all, great man. He cared about his players. What I loved about Roger was, and I was a fourth line guy, third, fourth line guy. He made me feel like I was such an important part of that game. You know, either before the game, during the game, or after the game when you saw the results. And he had a great knack for that. But just a good man. I forgot the question. What was your question?
Why, with Roger's influence on your playing career, why wouldn't you have become a coach rather than a manager?
I actually did. Jimmy DeVolano gave me the chance. It was the end of my career in Detroit. We were having a real tough year. I was 34 at the time, I believe, 33, 34. Yeah, I was towards the end of my career. They decided it was time to make changes. They're going to start bringing some young kids up. You know, the team was struggling. That was a real bad year for Detroit that year. So he offered me a chance to go down to Adirondack. That was the farm team then of Detroit, and be an assistant coach. Barry Melrose was down there. So I was Barry Melrose's assistant coach, and I was down there for almost 2 years. And I loved it, enjoyed it. And what happened was during that time, Brian Murray now became the general manager of Detroit. He had to make some changes, was going to make some changes down the minors. The Ottawa Senators were coming along. Mel Bridgman became the general manager. I played with Mel, and he was looking for people because of the expansion draft and everything. He offered me a chance to go to Ottawa. They really didn't have the team yet and said, why don't you come on board? I'm looking for people I know and trust. And I went with Mel to Ottawa, and that was the start of my managerial path, I guess. Started scouting for the expansion draft, did some pros, did some amateurs. We didn't have any, there was no organization yet. So I got to try everything, and I really started to enjoy the managerial part of it. And it took off from there.
Is it fair to credit or blame, as the case may be, Roger Neilson for the analytics world that we live in today?
Well, I think you need to give him credit for it. He was so, like, just the little things, you know, they had to put rules in because of Roger. Mm-hmm. He used to on face off the neutral zone. He was always thinking of new ideas. He'd have the guy sit at one end of the bench. If his face off was a certain part of the dot, depending on where the bench was back then, he'd have the other guy at the far end of the bench. He'd have the guy come off right off the draw and the guy go with the other door to try to get an advantage in the zone. The referee started to watch that. They put in a rule. He used to pull the goalie, and he'd have the goalie drop his stick in the crease. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they put that rule in. So he's very innovative that way. I still remember he had some great ideas. He had a dog. He just loved his dog.
Mike.
And Roger was trying to teach forwards how to forecheck. And he'd have the defenseman, you know, so defense was behind the net. How do you angle him? What's your angle and stuff? Well, some guys were having troubles picking it up. Well, he brought his dog out. He told the dog, don't let this guy get out behind the net. And the dog would just guy would start to walk out behind the net, the dog would move over this way. Dog would move over the other way to keep the guy. It was like herding sheep type of thing.
Yeah.
And he just, it was amazing on the things he thought of and different ideas he had. He was great.
Well, I, you know, those that are too young, or I mean, if you're old enough, you remember Roger Neilson. For those that are too young, these are the kinds of stories that are important to understand, because above all else, he was an innovator. And I don't have to tell you, there were people who thought he was nuts.
Yeah.
And then there was a coalition that said, you know, the guy's brilliant. The guy is way beyond anybody else in the game today. And you had the great opportunity to learn from him.
Yeah, no one, like, you know, he became Captain Video. Back then, nobody did video.
Yep.
Now, like I said, we talked about last night, we get on the plane, everybody's laptops are flipped up. Players are getting little tablets sent to them with their shifts. That was Roger Neilson. And he started this 40-some years ago.
So Bob asked about analytics. Where do you put analytics in with your team?
It's important that they are part of the game, or at least we got to figure out if they're part of the game, I guess, put it that way. What's the percentage? I don't know. We're digging into that. We work with two or three analytic companies. We've hired a firm that kind of works with us individually and is digesting all the information for us, and then they present it to us, and then we pass that on to more people. There's two directions you go. The one is with the team. How's your team playing? And the other one is players, amateurs and pros. How do you dissect that? So we still have I think our sport has a long ways to go yet with it. We're a little bit of a different, unique sport. You know, baseball analytics, it's a pitcher against a hitter.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of define those things. With us, you see some analytic numbers. You can have great analytic numbers, but the guy in net might change everything, or the post might change things. And so we're trying to find that balance where it comes into play. But it is an important part of the game. We're all looking for that extra 1% to be better than somebody else.
Isn't it all about context? Trying to figure out what the context is of the analytics?
Yes. Yeah. What are the parameters, or what's the one thing in analytics that you can say we need to, what can you define to say that this is going to help our team? What is it? Is there one or two things? There's so many numbers out there that you can get lost in it. But you need to have some consistency to it. And you need to find, is it five things or eight things or 10 things that you hang your hat on and say, let's dig into this. Let's stick with this and see if there's some results that either are positive or negative.
Before we let you go, the debate, you know, John and I are going to discuss it on the Olympics. Do you go? Do you not go? And, you know, this is an ongoing conversation that happens literally 12 months a year, every year. But with what has evolved, what the situation is in China now, the political situation, and with COVID and the risk that players may not get out of there for as much as 3 weeks afterwards, where do you sit on this, Jimmy?
Well, I'll probably sit on the fence just to make it easy for you. But no, I was fortunate. I played in the Olympics, and I played in 1980. And back then it was a little Lake Placid, and what a great thing to represent your country. And I've talked to my players. You know, I've got John Klingberg, who's 30 years of age. He knows this will be his last chance to ever go to the Olympics. And it's big for the players. So I fully understand that. To represent your country, there's no better honor. And to play against the best on best, these guys are wired. They love this type of competition. So I fully understand the players' point of view. Now, they also have their concerns. It's not like they're all saying, yeah, we got to go. They're smart. They're smart. They know the concerns. I think as we move forward, we'll see. Let's see where things are at. From the owner's point of view, from the management point of view, you know, February is probably our ideal business time to run our business for hockey. You know,
sure,
baseball's over, the NFL's over. There's a risk of injury of players going over. You know, affecting New York Islanders, the 1 year John Tavares got hurt. So there's that fear. The 1 year we had Steve Yzerman, I think that was Salt Lake City, had a bad knee and he went. Mm-hmm. We were concerned about him and it affected him a little bit. He missed some time coming back. So it can affect your business also. But I think it's great for our sport. It puts us on the global market. It sells our sport. Unfortunately, it's in a situation where it's in China during COVID. And this world just, it doesn't make it easy for us, but I know we'll make the right decisions. The players will make the right decisions. There's still some questions. You know, they talk about if you get COVID over there, how long do you stay there? How quick can you get back? A lot of unanswered questions. Let's see where it goes here the next 3 weeks. I think we'll have a better feel of where it's at. But
we've heard 3 weeks, like players would have to stay for as much as 3 weeks.
At least.
Yeah, at least. You know,
you're hearing different?
No, I've heard the same thing you have. I think they're still waiting to get, you know, it's not easy. You know, get confirmation from the Chinese Federation. Here's our rules and that. And
yeah,
communication isn't easy in those type of situations.
Okay, so you've got four goaltenders. Ben Bishop is in Austin, I guess, right now.
Yes,
is that right?
Correct. Yes. Correct.
Did he play last night?
Yeah, he did. Yes.
And how did he do?
He lost 8-4.
Eight.
That's yeah, eight. Good. Yeah, it was a tough night. No, tough night. He hasn't played for. Yeah, it's been almost 2 years, and it's tough.
But you have. I mean, Ottinger, Bishop, Holtby, Hudobin.
Yes.
Is your phone ringing?
I've been talking to teams. We're in a good situation. I've got, Holtby, who's been, he's kind of resurrected his career. He's been great for us. Everybody knows Anton Khudobin came in and took us to the Stanley Cup run. There's probably no better backup than Anton Khudobin. He's got that personality for it. And then Jay Gottinger, who last year was in the bubble with us, had to play because of the injuries to Bishop. We had him at camp. We thought he needed to play more games. We talked about these taxi squads. So we sent him down. He went down, played great. We had an injury up top. He's come up top and he's grabbed it. Mm-hmm. And so we got a good situation where I know I got three healthy goalies. I have the flexibility to send Jake Ottinger back down. He doesn't need waivers. So I got some flexibility. We're just kind of walking through it, see where things go. There's going to be injuries in the league. I know this much. It's better to have three than none. So we'll just kind of manage as we go forward.
So just curious, if the right offer comes, is it something that you might do well before the deadline?
The possibility. Yes. Yeah. I'm going to wait and see. You know, Jake's played six games now. Let's see where he's at. Does he keep grabbing it or does he hit a bump in the road? Do I get an injury with one of our guys? Can change things. So it's really... I'm flexible. I'm not cornered. You know, I can take my time, walk through this, and we'll see where things go.
We wish you continued success. And I say continued because obviously you've had great success in your role as a...
Hey Bob, can I ask one more question?
No, you can't, but okay.
Okay. I just listen.
Can't stop him, Jim.
No, I know. Jim knows that too. one of the great human stories in our sport is the relationship you and your wife have with the struggle your wife has gone through. Can you just tell us how you've been able to balance your life with your wife, Rebecca, who's battled cancer for a long time and appears to be coming through the other side pretty darn well? And how have you been able to do the balance of this non-9-to-5 world with the needs of your family and needs of what you need to, how you support your wife?
Yeah, well, you know what? She's a special person. She's really, the way she lives her life, it would have been easy for her to say, you know what, I quit or I have a pity party for me. She's never done that. And it's been all about her family. I've got a great family. We've got three kids, four grandkids, just had a grandchild 2 days ago.
Wow, so congratulations.
That. Yeah, so it's the best. But she's a special person. And what she's gone through and how she's lived it and accepted her, instead of sitting back and saying, you know, poor me, where's this going to go? She's the opposite. She has said, you know what, how can I spread my love to the world? And she has done that. And it's amazing to watch. If you ever get a chance to meet her, she's walking with God, and he's blessed her and us as a family. And just the way she handles herself and tries, her whole goal is she's been put on this world. How can I go help other people? And that's how she takes it.
And correct me if I'm wrong, she actually goes and advocates with cancer groups and with even at your games, correct? She hosts people?
Yeah, she hosts people. She gets treatments every 3 weeks. She'll have that for the rest of her life. And even when we go to when she goes to a treatment center at the hospital, she bumps into people. She's helping people there. There's people there in tough situations, and she'll walk up, put her arms around them and say, hey, I'm going through the same thing. Can I help you? And the friendships that we have made through all this, I remember the one time we went to a treatment center and, she's going through treatments, not feeling great about it, but you got to do it. And all of a sudden she looked across and here's a young girl that's 20 years of age with a baby going through treatments. And she's sitting there saying, Becky said, how can I got 4 kids and grandkids. God's blessed me. This poor young lady's 20 years of age. And so she'll help her out any way she can. And just who she is.
Puts the 4-0 loss in perspective though, doesn't it?
Well, that's the other thing. That's what's probably helped me. I can, we get frustrated, we get mad and stuff. And then I sit back, some players complain about his ice time. And I sit back and say, you know what? We'll work through this. So it's probably helped calm. I don't know if it was calm, but it's put a new perspective in life for me. When the wheels are coming off, I sit back and say, hey, come on. There's more things bigger in life and we'll get through this. It'll be okay. So it's helped that way. Thanks for asking.
We wish both of you continued good health, and we thank you very much for taking a few minutes for us while you're on the road. And hopefully we'll have a chance to do it again somewhere down the road. Thank you, Jim, very much.
Yeah, guys, thanks again for having me on. And look forward to seeing you around the rink here someday.
Merry Christmas, nice. Jimmy. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. All the best holidays to you guys. Take care.
And to thanks you. Jim Nell of the Dallas Stars. We'll come back and wrap after this message. Our thanks to Jim Nell for joining us. He's the GM of the Dallas Stars. A most interesting conversation. So since we last chatted, the Vancouver Canucks have put their front office and on-ice organization back in gear. Of course, they hired Bruce Boudreau and then hired Jimmy Rutherford.
Yeah, another guest of the podcast. So it's one
well,
of those
it's all things. Our guys. And I mean, clearly Vancouver can't come up with an idea on their own. All they do is watch or listen to this show, and we tell them what to do.
Sure. Well, and those people that are out of work.
And you're welcome, by the way.
Those people are out of work. You know how to contact us, and we'll interview you, and maybe you'll get a chance at a job.
Well, this was a little bit different, I think, in Vancouver. Hiring two guys that
two
had
senior
no,
citizens.
Well, there's that. But two guys that didn't have any kind of tie to the organization in any way, shape, or form, really.
And I think that's important.
Well, I do too. And I don't think it was accidental. I think it was probably pretty deliberate, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. What I've been told in the last couple of days is that when they finally decided to make a change, ownership... put two names on a piece of paper, and the names were Jim Rutherford and Bruce Boudreau, and they went out and got them, and they got the guys they wanted. And you can sit here and say, well, they talked about casting a wide net, and they had done their due diligence, had talked to people within the hockey world, and both Boudreau and Rutherford were the guys that were at the top of the list.
Have you talked to Jimmy by any chance?
Yep. I've talked to both of them, Jimmy's going to arrive in Vancouver this weekend and to evaluate what's going on. It's pretty easy to look at a team that Bruce has coached to two straight victories. And there's lots of talent in Vancouver. But really, I think the influence that Jim will have in the next 3 years, because that's the length of his contract, is how to restructure the front office. He's going to hire a general manager. He's probably got to rebuild the full hockey operations group, obviously working with people, some of the people that are still there, like Stan Smeal, Ryan Johnson. But there has to be I think when you hire somebody and you go outside and hire somebody like Rutherford, you know that you are making a paradigm shift in your game philosophy. And that's exactly what's needed in Vancouver at this point.
I'm told the owner flew to Carolina to talk to Mr. Rutherford. I gather because Jimmy wasn't 100% committed right from the get-go.
Here's what's interesting, Bob. Francesco Aquilini has been working a lot in the East in the last 2 weeks. In fact, met in person with both of them, as you mentioned, Jim, and then met with Bruce here in Toronto. It would be, what's today, Friday? So 9 days ago, met with Bruce 9 days ago here in Toronto. Bruce was in Ontario for some Hockey Canada meetings because he was supposed to go be an assistant coach at the Spengler Cup. Francesco and Bruce met, had a long discussion about what was going on. And then when they pulled the trigger on the Sunday morning after the Pittsburgh loss, Francesco watched the game like we did on Saturday night in Toronto. Huh. What happened was, he had his private plane fly from Toronto to Hershey, Pennsylvania, pick Bruce and his wife up, Candace, and flew back to Toronto. Francesco got on the plane and they flew to Vancouver. And that's how quickly the decision was made on the Sunday morning to get Bruce to Vancouver. And that's how Bruce was on the ice first thing Monday morning for the morning skate for their game on Monday night.
Do you believe Rutherford was essentially committed by the time Boudreau was announced as coach?
Yes, I do.
So he potentially could have
blessed Bruce Boudreau. I totally agree.
Or not.
Or not. Correct. But here's the fascination, and there's really when you think about synergy and coincidence, these guys played together a long time ago. They played in the NHL together for the Maple Leafs. They're both Toronto boys. They both have a simple passion for the game. They have been friends forever. They had joked in previous times and in previous places about, wouldn't it be great to work together one day? To me, this is just the fulfillment of that storyline, is that finally two guys have known each other for a long, long, long time. Get to work together in Vancouver.
So Rutherford will ultimately become the president of hockey ops,
which is what he is. That's what he is now.
Yeah, but we'll hire a general manager.
Correct.
Will that general manager have autonomy?
No.
Given Jim Rutherford's
No. But Jimmy Rutherford's 72 years old.
Oh no, I get it.
No, I think really, in many ways, this is where it's different than Montreal with Jeff Gorton being in that senior position and hiring a general manager. I think Jim Rutherford is there to mentor. I think he's in Vancouver to steer the ship, to get the right person in place, so that in 3 years, when Jim's 75, now Jim will say, I'm going to, 75, we'll see what happens, is that that Jim could give more autonomy to the manager at that point. But make no mistake about it, Bob, everything in Vancouver will run through Jim Rutherford's office.
Oh, I have no doubt about that. Look, at the reason he left Pittsburgh, quite shockingly and surprisingly, almost a year ago.
March. It was March.
I thought it was January.
It might have been. We had him on in March. I apologize. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Was essentially because he was getting some interference.
Yes.
He did not feel like he had the autonomy to make the decisions he had to make, wanted to make, that he'd had previously.
Well,
somebody was sticking their nose in.
David Morehouse is the president of the club. In fact, was actually told to he had to get rid of one of his assistant general managers that Jim did not want to do at the time.
Yeah.
So you're right. There was he would never say that publicly. I'm not sure he'd even say it privately. But there was certainly it became a point where Jim said, listen, if I can't do it my way, I don't want to do it here anymore. Right. And the Penguins and Jim decided to split.
But if you go back, if you go back and listen to that show that we did with him, it would become, my recollection is he made it quite clear that retirement wasn't really in his plan.
Definitely not. You know, I had actually heard that there was a lot of interest in Jim with Anaheim. Again, to be the president and then to nurture a new manager along in a two-man system. So, you know, in the short term, Jim will do both jobs until he finds somebody that he feels comfortable with to be that new general manager. And when you look at the lineage that he's created, I mean, Jason Botterill, Billy Guerin, Tom Fitzgerald, Jason Karmanos, Ron Francis. These are all people that are still in the game in various teams that Jim Rutherford touched, that Jim Rutherford made better people. Paul Maurice.
Yeah. Well, with no disrespect, but you stay in the game long enough and that's going to happen. And Jim Rutherford has been in the game since as long as I can remember.
Old as dirt.
We've got less than a minute here. And I wanted to talk about, and we'll do more of it in the coming days and weeks. Do you think the NHL is going to wind up going to China?
Just don't know yet. I think that they will try to make it work for the players. This was part of the commitment that that Gary Bettman made
to the
players when they got their four-year extension in the collective bargaining agreement. This was a commitment he made. I think they will try their damnedest to get to Beijing. Yes.
Well,
is that my personal preference? No, but I do think that they will try to make sure that everything happens to ensure that it does occur. January 10th is the key day, Bob. January 10th is the decision date that they have to make without paying any financial penalties. And we may even know before that, but there's probably a chance that we may not know that either.
That is all for us. Have yourselves a nice weekend. Thanks for watching or listening, as the case may be, for John Shannon, Bob McCowan. See you on Monday.